so serious.
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game, and still getting trying to play you.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game?
Yeah! Welcome to the toy department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, now more than ever, it's the toy department with Derek Madden and Matt Kolsky. I need this podcast in my life the way things are these days. You know what I mean?
I think we all need this podcast. It's, yeah, man.
I can't promise that the real world isn't going to leak into this some, because that's just where we are these
yeah,
days.
Yeah, I mean, well, when the real world starts dropping poo bombs into your toy department, like, sometimes there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah, this is the news fairy is coming along at an all-time pace last couple of weeks, for sure.
Yikes.
We have had a number of, there's a lot of show coming up today, by the way.
A lot of show.
We got Super Bowl coming up. We got to talk about. We've got a bunch of homework and stuff we got to cover. And we'll get to all that in a second. But I did want to check in really, really quickly. You and I have had a number of famous arguments on this show. You know, the hot dog, is it a sandwich argument? The college sports, are they entertaining argument? is golf a sport?
Yeah,
that's another long-running one. And those are things that I suspect that we'll never settle, mostly because you'll never admit you're wrong. But there is one that we can measure, I think, one of our arguments, somewhat
really
measurable, and that was, do you remember when, at the beginning of the season, when I said OKC could win 45 games and be a fringe contender?
I don't remember that specifically, but I do know that I clearly underestimated the Oklahoma City Thunder's likely win total. I still think 45 is probably about right. Like, I think they will fade, but clearly Russell Westbrook has lifted his team higher than I expected. There's no question.
I actually think they're going to win more than 45 games at this point. They need to go 17 and 15 the rest of the way for that to happen.
To win 45, I mean, like I said, I think 17 and 15 the rest of the way is a reasonable prediction. But
I'm not sure it'll be good enough to get them to fourth, though. 45. I think we underestimated the rest of the West a little bit.
I'm not sure I did. I do think that whether they win 45 or even 50 somehow, if they manage to do that, they are not. I mean, fringe contender, I don't know exactly what that means, but they have zero chance of winning anything real.
Yeah, that's correct.
Zero.
They can't beat the Warriors. And look, it was never...
They can't beat the Warriors. Yeah. They can't beat the Spurs. I don't think they could beat Utah.
Oh, I think they could beat Utah.
I don't think so.
But we'll see. And maybe they'll wind up playing. Who knows?
That would be... that. I would watch that. I'll tell you that much.
All right, we got bigger fish to fry, so let's start.
I like that you got us off to a smooth start by just pointing out how I was wrong, though.
That was good. It was good. Well, it's not often that I have, like, a measurable thing where I get, like, I gotcha!
That's true. And then I will say that the thing the Thunder really are benefiting from is that the Pelicans and Blazers are much worse than I expected, and the Timberwolves. All three of those teams are significantly worse than I would have thought.
Yes, although the Timberwolves on the come a little bit.
Yeah, and the Blazers a little bit as well, but still, those teams are 6 and 10 games under 500, and I expected them both to be over 500.
Yeah, I did too. I think next year, I think we've maybe been a year early on the Wolves. I think
on Minnesota, yeah. And I think the Blazers just, I think they did, Lillard and McCollum did such incredible things last year to get them to where they were, and I just think they don't quite have enough, but...
Well, I think both of those teams are lousy defensively. I think that's a big part of that.
That's a huge part of the problem. Yeah. But shocking that Minnesota is so lousy defensively.
It is a little shocking. I agree. I think they don't quite have the Tibbs personnel yet, and I think
or the buy-in fully. I don't think. I know, or maybe it's not buy-in, but they haven't figured it out yet.
Right. They don't know. Well, and maybe they're starting to. I think this run is encouraging to me. Yep. And tonight they're playing the Cavs, which I think will be an interesting test given where the Cavs are currently at.
No question.
But they, you know, they to me, they remind me a lot of the first couple of seasons of Steph on the Warriors, in which they had some talent but didn't understand how to win games. And so they'd be competitive and lose a lot of games in the fourth quarter. And the Wolves were terrible in the second half for almost the first half of the year. And I think that's getting better. I think they're learning how to close out games, which to me, I don't believe that in a lot of other sports, but I think that is a real actual skill in the NBA that teams kind of have. It's a place teams kind of have to get over the hump, you know?
History certainly suggests that, right? Because almost every major team except the championship Warriors of a couple of years ago has a slow, steady progress through the playoffs, you know?
Right.
Over years, not over a single year.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't think Minnesota's going to make the playoffs this year, and I don't know that they should. I sort of vacillate back and forth between whether or not they should try to. or if another lottery pick would help them.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I think another pick would help, but I will say if they keep playing like this, they have a decent chance because the eighth spot is wide open.
Very wide open. It's going to be a fun year in the NBA. Do you want to stay there? Because we got a couple of NBA things to talk about. Or, you know, we were sort of talking about the real world creeping in, which dovetails nicely into the Black-ish episode I assigned. So which of those directions would you like to go?
I don't know. Let's clean up the homework first and talk Black-ish.
All right. So we assigned the Black-ish episode Lemons, which was about the aftermath of the election, and I'm just curious, as a person, you've never seen the show, correct?
Correct.
As a person coming into it dry, what were your thoughts? How do you think they handled it, and what do you think of the show in general?
Well, first of all, you know, in as much as you can tell anything from one episode of a 30-minute sitcom, it's a fun show. It's enjoyable. And I think, broadly speaking, they did a decent job of, you know, like you said, the toy department is being invaded. And at a certain point, there's only so much you can do to keep the real world out. And I think, you know, if we sort of grant them that they couldn't, it would have been, I don't know if irresponsible is the right word, but it would have been awkward to keep the real world out of a show that addresses issues that are so intimately tied to issues in the real world, that I think they managed conceptually bringing the real world into this 30-minute sitcom.
Can you think of another show that, like on network television, that's going to address this stuff so directly and specifically? Because I can't.
I can't even think of one
that will come close, to be honest.
Yeah, and I thought Anthony Anderson's sort of big speech in the episode was excellent.
Yeah.
I mean, excellent. The writing was tremendous. He delivered it. It was excellent. I would ask you this, though.
Okay.
If they made that episode today, do you think the tone would be different? Because I found myself wishing they didn't entertain some of the things they entertained.
I think the tone would be different, but probably only slightly. I mean, I think you're still going to end on the note of hope because it's a network sitcom. You know what I mean?
Yeah. But just they. This is my problem, right? I mean, the reason I have to have a podcast, as you said, that we desperately need these days. The reason I need a toy department podcast is because I get angry, and I found myself very uncomfortable with a woman being portrayed as decent and somewhat reasonable when she voted for Donald Trump, and especially after the first week of the administration. I guess it's just if that woman was in my office, I would not have a civil conversation.
Interesting. Like,
I'd be unable to at this point.
I thought the character's reasoning, you know, I disagree with it violently, but I do. Didn't you understand where she was coming from, at least?
I understood where she was coming from. But again, after a week of a Trump, watching it after a week of Trump being president, all the things she said were so stupid and offensive. and the entire position of, well, yeah, he's a human train wreck, and he's going to erode civil rights and fight desperately against women's rights and hurt everyone from a healthcare perspective and detain immigrants and non-immigrants for based on their religion, essentially, like, to then have her go, yeah, but my dad's out of work, is like, oh, yeah, fuck you, lady. That argument now is so blindly selfish and it's despicable.
Yeah, see,
it's despicable to say, well, my dad's out of work, so I'm going to vote for a moral train wreck because maybe he'll get my dad a job. Like, that is, it's low, and it's repulsive to me. And maybe it was less so before Inauguration Day.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I really see. Now we're going to get into this. We're firmly out of the toy department, but fine. Like, I don't know if I agree with, hey, my family's out of work. Our town is desolate and destroyed, and we don't know if it's ever going to get better. I don't know that you can say being worried about that is selfish. Like, those are real concerns that you as a human being have to take care of. I'm not necessarily saying that they trump civil rights and that those things aren't important.
Okay,
but,
well, let me use,
but like, that's a
Trump
real thing that real people
well
are dealing with. Sorry, that was not a pun intended, I swear.
I'm not saying real people don't feel that way. I'm saying I have no respect for those people. And here's why. It's because, and then look, this is an extreme example to the point of stupidity, but hang with me. If my father works at a grocery store, just for the sake of argument, and that grocery store goes out of business, all right, and he only has the skills, or his skills are best designed to be the assistant manager of a grocery store, and he goes down the street to another grocery store and says, hey, I need a job. I'm an excellent assistant manager. And they say, sorry, we have an assistant manager already. And then he goes all over town to 7 different grocery stores. And then none of them have an assistant manager job. It's unfortunate. I feel bad for that guy. I wish him the best of luck. But it's not okay if he murders one of the assistant managers to get a job.
Okay.
And to me,
that's a very extreme example.
I did that on purpose, but the point is, a vote for Donald Trump was a vote against decency. It was a vote for the persecution of your fellow countrymen.
All right.
It was a vote
that's an interpretation of that vote. You're interpreting someone else's decision when you say that.
I'm not saying it's a deliberate vote for those things, but it is factually a vote for those things.
Well, and effectively, I think it may be a more appropriate term there.
Effectively, in real life, in the real world, effectively, essentially, it is a vote for those things. And I'm sorry, but everyone who said, oh, these are just campaign rhetoric things, it's not real, much more interested in...
The big loser of the week is the, you took him literally when you should have taken him seriously crowd. It was all literal.
Right.
Yeah,
or the give him a chance crowd. Or the, oh, it's more about disruption than white power. No, clearly it's more about white power. We have seen that. And again, that's why maybe before the election, I was in a place where I was more willing to talk to someone who was still defending their vote. But by the time I watched this episode, I was in a place where if you were still defending your vote, you just suck.
Well, I would.
I mean, a week in, 10 days in, whatever it is, if you are still standing by your vote for this man after watching what he's done, I don't believe you're a good human. I just don't.
Yeah, see, I think I mean, and maybe this gets back into more personal beliefs, but I first of all, I took a hopeful note. I watched this, you know, obviously I watched it when it aired before we knew a lot of this stuff. And then I watched it again last night.
I think that's part of the problem.
But, you know, I watched it again last night to try to have, you know, to see how it ages. And I look, it's really tough to you can't really judge a work of art on things that happen after the work of art is produced.
No, again, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, that's why I said it was a good episode. The show seems good. This is not necessarily me hating on the show. This is just me talking about my personal feelings.
But I
watching
feel like
that woman. I'm sorry that your crappy white trash town is falling apart. I am. And I realize I said that in an offensive and dismissive way. But, like, it sucks that people are out of work around the country. But also, it's a fact of life. And to throw away the most important values of our country in the interest of my dad needs a job, I'm sorry, I can't see that as anything but selfish.
Or in the safety above all else, I think it's sort of the same thing. But, you know, and maybe this is just the way that we look at life and government and things. To me, I think you need to get back to the place where you were. We have to be able to talk to some of these people for 4 years, not all of them. I mean, they're the deplorables that are unreachable, but you know what I mean? Like you're going to have that conversation if things are going to get better.
Here's an honest question. I mean this completely honestly.
Okay.
If you're still, if for the people that are still go Trump right now, today, are still sent after the detainings, after the firing of an attorney general who wanted to uphold the Constitution, after reports of an executive order to erode LGBTQ rights, after all of the stuff that's happened, after the quickest attempt ever to strip health care from millions of Americans, after all of this, for the people still in the Trump zone, what percentage of those people do you think actually care about the values America was founded on and actually believe in equality and rights for everyone and human decency?
That's the thing. I think it's way, way higher than you think. And now that you've said a number, I know that's the case. All right, look, we're gonna get this. Will be a quagmire for us. I just want to make one final point about this whole thing. That the Anthony Anderson speech at the end. I mean, look, I thought this episode was really well done. All the way through, like every scene had a purpose. There are a lot of really interesting points that were made. The thing at the end, you know, and really Anthony Anderson gives a speech in this office about in his office about how, you know, black people have always been on the losing side, basically, and that they're used to that. Honestly, that's the kind of thing that I was like, yeah, you're right. Like, we lost, you know, but there is still a fight to be had. And I can't wallow in the sorrow every day of the week. And that was something that was useful for me to hear, even now. In fact, more so now maybe than it was when that episode originally aired.
I agree with that. But you know what I kept thinking during that as a white guy? I kept thinking, yeah, he's right. And you know what that makes me want to do? Is that makes me, who has frankly not been, I mean, look, the Jews have lost some too, but for the most of my life, I have not been.
No, man, everybody lost in the Holocaust.
I'm just saying. All Holocaust lives matter. I'm just saying, my feeling was, he's right, and he shouldn't have to be the one angry. It should be me.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, hey, if a show
my
did
thought
that,
was,
I think it succeeded in a way, right? You know what I mean?
Well, but just thinking to myself, you know what? Like, I get it, because people who have been more actively discriminated against their entire life than me, they are used to this. But the fact that black people have unfortunately become used to this sort of thing just makes me feel like I have not done a good enough job as a privileged white boy of screaming about these things when they happen.
All right, privileged white boy. I have another way to look at this, but we'll handle that off the pod, I feel like.
All right.
Because we should move on.
We're going down a dangerous road.
We are. Remember, we promised escape for people, and then we were a total bummer for a while. So should we jump into Migos?
Yeah, probably.
That'll make you happy.
Yeah, it will.
The new Migos record is out today. Apparently, it was the talk of the Super Bowl media day the other day.
Yeah.
You know, Migos is from Atlanta. Falcons are very much on board with Migos.
I really hope that Lady Gaga brings out the Migos at her halftime show.
I was secretly hoping for some sort of like ATL hip-hop takeover of Houston this weekend. I'm still holding out some hope for that there's just like a 2 Chainz, Migos, T.I., like Gucci Mane, like just sort of like
that would make me so happy. Also, even just, I wish there had been a prop bet on this, but I did not see one, like a shot of Gucci in the crowd.
Yeah.
Like over under half, one half appearance on television. Gucci Mane.
If I'm the Falcons, I'm bringing I'm putting all those dudes on the sideline for the game.
Oh hell, you know what, yeah! I mean?
Like they're alumni, you know?
Yes. Like Snoop at every single college game.
All right, so the record's out. It's called Culture. You assigned this for me, so I'll take your thoughts first on it.
Okay. 2016, as I have tweeted previously, was the year that I learned to let go and embrace trap music. And I would say the principal vehicle for that acceptance was the Young Thug album, Jeffrey. But one of the exciting parts of it was diving into Migos a little bit. And I'm just so happy that this group is moving forward in a progressive way. And all I mean by that is they're getting better at what they do. What they do may not be super complicated, or, you know, look, I'm a fan of classic hip hop. Don't get me wrong. Like, you can't beat some of the classic 90s records for me. You know, that's just my era. And this stuff is not on that level from like an adult artistic standpoint, but it's feel good music, man. And the beats bang, and they have elevated the hip hop or rap ad lib to a level I could not have imagined, with their goofy yells and shouts after every line. They've turned, like, you get the feeling of the tracks from some of the ad libs. In certain songs, the ad libs are slowed down and like sung in like a you know, heartfelt way. Other times they're just like yelling a random word at the end. It's just, the whole thing is like a celebration of goofy excess and fun. And I just, as much as this is a time for me to be angry at the world, it's also a time where I need the Migos, man. I really do. And it makes me feel good. And every single track on this album, I will turn up to 50 in my car stereo and goofily thug out to on the Bay Area highways. There's a couple of tracks. I mean, I think Bad and Bougie people know. If I had to pick one track that has not been a major single yet that is like a real earworm, I would pick the Gucci Mane feature, Slippery. But it's just, it's unbridled, unadulterated, goofy trap fun, and honestly, I just love it.
All right, that was quite a bit. I'll jump in there and say this: like, I had a different feeling a little bit about this record. You know, obviously this is Migos' moment right now, like in the culture. There's a definite recognition. Obviously, Donald Glover gave him the shout out at the Golden Globes that, like, you know, and there's certainly a fever pitch for this album. And Bad and Bougie, if it's not the number one song in the country, and I think it may be.
It's in there.
It will be shortly. Like, it's having a moment. And I ain't got nothing to say about Bad and Bougie, man. That is a fun ride. And I like some other tracks on this record, including the one that you mentioned,
Slippery. Yeah,
Slippery. The 2 Chainz feature, Deads, was really good too, I thought. You know, there were a few more. I had the opposite feeling though, of like, I kind of wish this was like an EP. You know, and Bad and Bougie still stands like head above the rest of it, and it gets, the songs are simple, and to me it gets a little repetitive, you know, as an album experience.
There is truly no fundamental difference between the lyrical content of any of the songs on this record.
Yeah.
And beats-wise, like, they have a particular style that they don't stray from.
Right.
So I'll give you that. Repetitive, it is repetitive. Yeah. I'm just saying, it's repeating something that I want to turn up really loud in my car and, like, act like a 12-year-old.
Yeah, I say this not to, not to invalidate anything that you were saying. Because, you know, the Migos record, it's the, you know, the old breakup line. Like, it's not you, Migos, it's me. You know what I mean? Like, it's me when I say this, but, like, you know, this is a record lyrically that is kind of obsessed. It's obsessed with a lot of things, tater tots,
mostly drugs, like, and boobies,
and drugs and boobs. But one of the things is culture. You know, and there's a there's a line about, you know, you're talking about modern hip hop, but you don't get the culture, and that is me. I'm that, and I don't. This is not a record that I feel in my bones. I can listen to it, I can enjoy it, I can nod my head to it. But other than Bad and Bougie, which I'm sure I will play nonstop for a long time, I'm going to forget the rest of it immediately. And
yeah, I mean, look, Bad and Bougie, really, we should pay special homage, because it really is one of those songs where, like, right after it ends, you're like, I can listen to that again.
Yeah, totally. And I have. But, like, I just, you know, it doesn't speak to me on that emotional level. I would rather watch Migos be on Atlanta. I would rather listen to you talk about how much you like the Migos record than listen to most of the Migos record. And that, like, again, that's not Migos' fault. It's mine. And I'm willing to acknowledge that.
You know what? But that's, I fully accept that. And that's, I don't think that's unreasonable. And honestly, that's what I meant about the last year, that the Young Thug record really, like, I don't know why. But for whatever reason, listening to that record just was the point for me where I allowed myself to be like, you know, forget all of the stuff you're talking about, essentially. Because I felt a lot of that. Like, a year ago today, if you had asked me about Migos or Young Thug or Gucci Mane, I'd have said almost exactly what you're saying. Like, it's fun. I see that it's fun. It's not that I immediately want to turn it off when it comes on. But I don't totally get it, and it's hard for me to just, like, listen to.
Yeah, I'm not, like, invested in it, you know?
Yeah, but somewhere for me, somewhere in the middle of last year, and I don't know if it was my emotions from the non-toy department just, like, driving me up a wall, but at a certain point I was just like, you know what? Who cares if the lyrics don't speak to me? Who cares about this stuff? Just, like, let go and let this absurdist stuff wash over me, and somehow it just, like, it exploded in my brain, and it makes me feel good.
All right, so speaking of fun escapism, I have a little thing that I want to talk about that sort of segued to me into a larger point about music criticism, and you know, that for me is the Chainsmokers. Who you're probably at least sort of marginally familiar with. They've been ruling the pop charts for the last year and a half.
I am more familiar with them conceptually than literally.
Yeah.
Go on.
So they have a new single, Paris. You know, I'm not a person. I don't own a Chainsmokers album. I haven't listened to it all the way through or anything like that. But I do think this song is kind of like a heat-seeking missile of a pop song, in that it's it's just designed to be an earworm, and it does it so well that I sort of, kind of like you in Trap, just sort of let go and said, all right, you win this one, Chainsmokers. I'm going to play a little bit of this.
We were staying in Paris to get away from your parents, and I thought, wow, if I could take this in a shot right now, I don't think that we could work this out. Out on a terrace, I don't know if it's fair, but I thought, how could I let you fall by yourself? Well, I'm wasted for someone else. If we go down, then we go down together.
And then literally from the rest of the song, it's 3 minutes of hooks. You know what I mean? And
yeah,
you know, let me guess,
in the video, they're like making out with women.
I have no idea. I haven't seen the video. We talked about when I went to Voodoo Fest earlier in the summer, and Arcade Fire was playing and no one showed up because everyone was watching Chainsmokers, and it kind of like weirded me out. And, you know, this song, I think, is like the fifth single from this album. The first four all went to number one. They've been, like, destroying the pop charts this year. And in a time when...
In a world.
But in a time where music criticism has kind of leveled out so that really being heard is almost the most important thing, right? That there are all these things that, you know, the pop people have kind of taken over. Like, you can't, you know, people like Taylor Swift are sort of, you know, that's seen as a value, right? That you are popular and accessible and making hit songs. And I read this piece in the Village Voice that sort of decried, like, well, Chainsmokers is huge this year, and Lemonade was not. Like, Lemonade was not a success on the pop charts. And, you know, this must mean misogyny, because the last Chainsmokers hit, Closer, I guess, is, you know, it's about a girl, and the guy doesn't, like, it's a girl. It's like the guy's talking about an old hookup that he doesn't like all that much. Now, I have a, like, to me, I have a really hard time with the idea that any song that's about a specific woman is somehow misogynist. Like,
yeah.
I feel like all of us, every male has probably felt not great about an ex. If they wrote a song about him, it would not be great. And I'm pretty sure that works the other way. You know what I mean?
I was going to say, every woman has 5 minimum.
And when we're talking about, you know, I mentioned Taylor Swift. She's literally built a career.
Yeah.
And so,
absolutely.
Like, no, you know, hey, like, more power to her. I don't begrudge her that. You know, good for you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you got that, dude. But that's the thing, is to me, the things that are sort of not bulletproof in this pop empire that we have today are bros. And this is, like, honestly, this is the most, like, alt-right point I'm ever going to make on a podcast, I promise. But, like, it's not okay to be a bro for some reason in pop culture. So,
for some reason?
I mean, yeah, okay. Look, I'm not talking about the general bros of life, but that doesn't really have anything to do with the music. But if you read a review...
But no, hold on. Well, let me stop you, because it may not have anything to do with the music, but I do think it has something to do with the reaction, right?
Yeah, it sure does. It's music critics who, like, music critics don't like bros, right? So, like, as people, right? So, to me, like, they see these signifiers and okay, here's an interpretation of what I can make of why this is not good, because I don't like bros, and Chainsmokers is a little bro-y, and Calvin Harris is a little bro-y, you know what I mean? Like, and so now those become the things that it's okay to make fun of, but we have to accept Taylor Swift, and we have to accept Beyonce, you know, and Rihanna, and anything else that sort of means, because that scene is somehow more authentic. And I guess I reject the notion that bros, I'm not a bro, but I reject the notion that they can't make authentically good pop music, particularly since the world seems to be really liking it. You know what I mean?
I think authentic and pop music are words that probably don't belong together.
Right. But, you know, I feel like rock criticism needs to apply that authenticity in some way, right? In a in a world in which in where cool has been kind of the I don't know if de-stratified is the word, but you know what I mean? Like they've taken all of that out.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Where credibility, you know, is sort of a 90s paradigm now, right?
Yeah.
In that world, you know, then how, you know, what is the function of the critic, right? So,
I mean,
I
think
I feel like they can latch on to.
If we're going to bicker about authenticity, don't you think that the content of Lemonade is more authentic than Chainsmokers?
Yeah, look,
it's more personal, it's more real. Like, again, I know Chainsmokers mostly as a theory.
Yeah.
But, like, based on what you said and what I have heard, like, it seems like, yeah, that song is about one random breakup that maybe he doesn't feel great about.
Well, that's pretty personal. Like, by the way,
Does it feel like a personal song in the way that Lemonade feels personal? I'm not sure it does. It feels like it could be any broken relationship.
Yeah,
and you could be talking about anyone or no one, and that you just made up a thing about a girl you don't like that much because that's a thing that happened, as opposed to, you know, Lemonade or Anti, which feel like they're real albums about the people who wrote and made them.
Yeah, I'm not trying to argue the greatness of Chainsmokers vis-a-vis Lemonade.
No, I know.
But I don't believe that it's a crime that audiences chose the Chainsmokers over Lemonade.
It's not a crime.
You know what I mean?
I think it speaks to an unfortunate reality about people's taste in music across the world at large. And I think that's the reality that anyone who's been paying attention for the last 50 years is already pretty aware of.
I guess. I mean, look, you can certainly say that Lemonade is a more personal statement. The Chainsmokers record is a much more melodic record. Like it's very successful on that level,
but that's pure pop.
Sure,
that's fine.
That's the game they're playing. You know what I mean?
Technotronic's "Pump Up the Jam" was one of the first singles I ever owned. That doesn't mean it's good, authentic music. It means it's an earworm.
I would definitely argue that "Pump Up the Jam" is good authentic music, but maybe that's just me.
You know what I mean, though.
I know what you mean, but
I could have picked Britney Spears. You know what I mean? Did I get down to some Britney Spears in college? You bet your butt I did.
Oh yes, yeah. See, I never got on that board.
Well, I'm a little younger than you, but twist the knife. That doesn't speak to the great quality of Britney Spears. You know, the Chainsmokers are they make mediocre pop music, which is fine.
Here's the thing, though, and I'm glad you brought up Britney Spears, because I do think that there is some validity in those songs, in those songs are still part of the cultural iconography 20 years later. Like there's a bit of the test of time that sort of levels all this stuff out, and all of these things, these credibility things, like, oh, that's a little bro-y, you know, that is the, oh, Alanis Morissette is a safe version of female rage of today. You know what I mean? Like all of these sort of criticisms that we have that are based on identities and things like that, they're not going to matter down the road. What's going to be left is the songcraft, and that itself is going to determine whether or not things. So we're wasting our time on. Well, it's a little bro-y. Like that's we're wasting
okay,
our time.
Fine, you might be right, but to me, the songcraft is on par with Britney Spears, not on par with really good music.
Yeah, and yeah. See, that's the thing is, I think
and that's fine. Songcraft. When you're a pop band, songcraft is not so much songcraft as it is song programming to fit the like pop standards and to hit. Look, human beings mostly have buttons you can press with music, and over time we've figured out where those buttons are and what those buttons sound like.
But
you can make a song that's nothing more than a button press.
Don't you
and
think
to me,
like,
that's what the Chainsmokers are? And that's fine. They're allowed to do that. But I think Lemonade, and I only keep bringing it up because it's an example you chose as something that didn't do as well. To me, Lemonade is more than a
pushing
album.
I didn't choose it, by the way. This was the piece. I'm taking this from the piece
of
the voice.
Well, I'm just saying, it doesn't have to be Lemonade. It could be, we could pick Solange's record, which you didn't love. But again, she's doing a different thing than the Chainsmokers are, and her thing is, to me, more authentically about music and less about pushing the buttons in the pleasure centers of the average human brain.
Yeah, but and I get that. Look, I get there's a different degree of difficulty in a record like Lemonade or A Place at the Table, 100%.
It's not even necessarily difficulty. I mean, it is, but it's not just difficulty to me. It's philosophy.
But there's still – here's what I'm saying is, like, there's still an achievement to be made in pushing those – and having the understanding to push those buttons better than anybody else. And I'll put this to you in kind of this question form.
Just to be clear, before you put the question, I completely agree with what you just said. There's definitely a skill and a talent to being able to push those buttons the best. That's what Britney Spears was. That's what Katy Perry has been. That's what the Backstreet Boys did, NSYNC, and that's what the Chainsmokers are doing.
I'm so glad you went on that rant, because that gets you exactly to my question, which is Max Martin, who, by the way, made every single one of those songs that you just mentioned, is he a genius?
Yeah, in his own way. Yeah, absolutely.
To me, I don't even think you have to qualify with this in his own way. You know, at this point,
well, you're right. Everyone who's a genius is a genius in their own way. You're right. He's a genius in a segment of the culture and with abilities that don't matter a ton to me. But certainly, I think when you elevate above the rest of what you do to the degree that Max Martin has, yeah, I think it's fair to call him a genius.
That man has shaped the sound of popular music in America, I think probably on a scale
for 20 years.
For more than that. And has, like, disciples now that are yep, like, out there doing the same thing. It's insane. And I think people don't even realize the depth and variants of these things. Like, there, it's a lot. You know, he sneaks into a lot of different things. And I think when you think of most of the classic pop songs of the last 25 years, he's had a hand in them. And I think that's a really good example.
It is, and it's an impressive achievement. And I think, you know, again, genius is fair if you look at it that way. But also, it's just a less interesting and impressive achievement to me than people who are trying to make music as art, because that's not what Max Martin does. He makes music as escapist entertainment.
Right. But I mean, I think I feel like we just covered in the last discussion that there's a real value to that, particularly at this moment
sure.
in our lives. So,
yeah. Yeah, you know, and you make a good point, because it's more taste than anything that makes me prefer the Migos to the Chainsmokers.
Yeah. And I'm not here to advocate for the Chainsmokers. I'd say the same thing about a Chainsmokers record that I did about the Migos record, that I think there's, you know, one or two really great singles that kind of make me happy, but the rest of it I would probably never listen to again. In fact, I haven't really listened to the Chainsmokers album all the way through, and I don't expect I will. But, you know, That Song Paris comes on the radio, I'm happy. You know what I mean? Like, for a minute, my head is bobbing, and I'm, you know what I mean? And then the hook comes in. The hook is fantastic. You know, I'm there. And I value
job,
that right
basically.
Now. Yeah, it does it really well. And I think just because it's like, you know, because it's a white dude in a T-shirt,
help.
You know, or a couple white dudes in a T-shirt, like we're allowed to go, this is not important.
And the name Chainsmokers doesn't help.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to Sneaky Pete, which is a show that debuted last week, I think, on
Amazon.
Somewhere
around there. It's on Amazon, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like with, you know, Netflix has a bit of a distribution advantage now that in which they drop something, it's a little easier for it to catch fire, whereas not quite as many people have Amazon, and maybe these things don't get noticed in the same way, but
mm-hmm.
I thought Sneaky Pete was pretty entertaining. I've seen a few of the episodes, I think maybe four, and I'm on board all the way through.
I'm fully on board. I've only watched two, but I'm glad we watched more than one, because not that one wasn't good. I mean, I was in after one, but I do think the second episode, where you start to get the backstory and they flush out the characters a little more, it opened up a world of this show to me that I'm very interested in spending time in. And I was reminded delightfully at how much I, about how much I love Giovanni Ribisi.
Yeah, and I think he's really at his best.
Yeah,
in this show, you know, you sometimes Ribisi can play a little bit goofy.
Yeah, and also he's played really out there characters. He's played disabled character at least once. So he's taken some bizarre parts, but this does play to his strengths as an actor.
Yeah, slightly sleazy Giovanni Ribisi, I think, is the best Ribisi.
Right, slightly sleazy, but like morally, he is a moral guy. Mm-hmm. You know, decent but slightly sleazy. Sneaky Pete is the perfect name for this show.
Yeah,
and. It also features a lot of, I mean, obviously Cranston's great, but a lot of the other actors in it, most of whom's names I don't know offhand, are like character actors I enjoy seeing as well.
This is one of those things, because you don't watch The Americans. There are two people who featured prominently in The Americans, Allison Wright, who someday you will come to treasure for her performance on that show, and I'm not going to say anything else because I do expect you to watch that someday. And character actress Margot Martindale, who I say that because that's her character on BoJack Horseman.
She is so good.
Character actress Margot Martindale is, in fact, to me, one of the best working actresses on TV, bar none. She's good in everything.
Yeah.
If you saw her turn on Justified, she was kind of the sort of the big bad for a while on that show. The depth of her performance is incredible. She's great in The Americans. I guess she's on a CBS sitcom that's probably terrible, but everything else I've seen her in is fantastic. And I'm so excited for her here because you can tell she's got a meaty role where she's going to be able to do that thing where she kind of is like the hefty old lady that you don't really expect. But man, there's a lot going on under there. Yeah.
The sort of the lioness, if you will.
Yeah. And I'm really looking forward to, seeing what she's going to be doing on the rest of the series, because she's brilliant. And you can tell they created that role with her in mind. The show's done by Graham Yost, who did Justified, and I believe worked on some other FX stuff. And this one's a definite recommend for me. It's also a pretty easy watch. Like it's a fun, breezy
fun
show. Yeah.
And so let's quickly say, I had you read a short story because the minute there's a scene in the opening episode, in the pilot, if you will, I'll just spoil it. It's not much of a spoiler, but Giovanni Ribisi is a confidence man. And there's a scene in the first episode where he pretends to be a Canadian from Montreal and tricks this hockey fan into, like, befriending him, and then proceeds to steal everything off of his body. From his wallet to his watch to his phone, just like in 30 seconds, takes everything out of his pockets and the watch off his wrist. And frankly, the moment I saw that, I was hooked. And in part, it's because it immediately took me back to maybe my favorite, certainly one of my favorite short stories of all time, which is called The Hitchhiker by Roald Dahl. And you read it, yeah?
I did read it, yeah.
So you see the connection, right?
Yeah, I did. And somehow, even though, I sort of figured out at some point that's what you're getting at, the end of that short story still surprised me.
Right? it's a delightful short story, and it's like a 10-minute read, so I would recommend it to anyone. And if you just Google The Hitchhiker Roald Dahl, you'll find a copy of it printed online that you can read. I'll put a link in the description. But I read that story as a little kid. And it's going to spoil the story slightly, but not completely, to say that story is in part about a guy who is the greatest pickpocket in the world. And and who would not appreciate being called a pickpocket, as a matter of fact.
That's right. Fingersmith.
And fingersmith, yes. Which, and I've never forgotten the fingersmith, and in some small way, I have always wanted to be a fingersmith who could steal the watch off someone's wrist. And the minute Giovanni Ribisi did that, I was like, oh, I am all in on this show, because honestly, this character of the sort of out of luck, very talented con man with a heart, it's one of my favorite types of characters. It's the sort of character that fits perfectly into my favorite genre of film, which is the action comedy romance. You know, this guy would be right at home in Bruges, and watching this sort of character is just my favorite thing, because they can be funny and clever, but they also have a heart and have things that are important to them, and they're not just this empty criminal. And I just love watching a talented, you know, writing staff or showrunner or whoever's responsible that you want to give credit to build a character like this and add layers to it and sort of paint the humanity of someone that I think would be easy to write off as just like, oh, he's just a small-time criminal.
Yep. And I feel like the less conflicted, the not anti-heroes in this story are also fleshed out very well, and not sort of necessarily cartoon cutouts of bad guys, and those are, you know, it's a great milieu from which to paint that sort of crime story underworld sort of thing, and I think the show does it well, so I'm going to recommend that one, and I feel like you're
way,
on board too.
Absolutely on board. Just a quick note. In addition to being the show creator and executive producer of Justified, as you mentioned, and he's actually an EP on The Americans as well, Graham Yost wrote Speed, Broken Arrow, and Hard Rain.
Yeah, he's so good. Like, he's good at this.
He's good at this. This is what he does.
Were you a Justified watcher?
The rest of it. I wasn't, but it's like it's on the list with The Americans of like shows I really do want to watch but haven't found time for yet.
Yeah, and just look, Justified is definitely a little more pulpy than The Americans is, for
but
sure.
I love Timothy Oliphant.
If you love Timothy Oliphant, yeah, you definitely should see it. And the other thing
I know.
You know.
I know I should.
Yeah, like the acting, it's a showcase. So
and it's got Goggins too. I mean, it has two of my favorite actors.
Yeah, and
so
Goggins,
I
it's Pete Goggins.
To watch it.
It's Pete Goggins.
Pete Goggins. So, I'm excited about that.
Yeah, for sure. Now, I want to say that you like Natalie Zay as well, right? Am I making that up?
No, you're not making that up.
Yeah, she's you should watch Justified.
Do people not like Natalie Zay?
I feel like that's impossible. It's either you like Natalie Zay or you don't know who she is. It's kind of right.
Right.
Those are the choices. So
yeah. No, I mean, yeah. I don't think there's not like I don't there's no like I don't like Natalie Zay the committee. That's not a thing.
No, I agree. Kolsky, my team's in the Super Bowl. I just like to mention that every now and again.
Oh boy! Hey, how are you?
You know, I'm getting to be a little bit more of a wreck. I'm certainly aware of the fact that my team's in the Super Bowl, and I keep mentioning it to people. But the magnitude of it is kind of starting to hit me. so
only the second time you've gotten to experience this, and it's very different than the last time because this team belongs.
Well, all right. You know, I'm going to stick up for the 99 Falcons really quickly because people, they beat the Vikings in the NFC Championship game, and that Vikings team was 15-1. And so everybody's like, it should have been them. I'm just going to point out that Atlanta Falcons team, their regular season record was 14-2. And I can't imagine another 14-2 team that people would say, they don't belong in the Super Bowl. I'll just say that.
When I say this team belongs, it's not that I'm saying that the 99 team was an illegitimate Super Bowl entrant, that they earned their way. They just
they got their butt kicked a little bit.
Not only they got their butt kicked, but I think like that they predictably got their butt kicked.
I didn't go into that game because I remember that very well. I definitely did not go into that game thinking this is hopeless.
Okay.
You know, but I do feel much better about this Falcons team's chances, which I also think is sort of weird. Look, now we look at the...
There are similarities, right?
Those two Denver Super Bowl teams as, like, juggernauts, but they hadn't really won it. I was 99 the second one?
Yeah. The second one.
Like, it didn't, to me, seem like the same sort of formality that I think it does looking back on it 20 years later. But that's the thing.
Maybe not.
I was going to ask you this. Like, if you were, if I said to you, the Bears are going to make the Super Bowl next year, who is the team that you would least want to face in that Super Bowl?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's the Patriots.
It's the Patriots, right? And here we are. So, not just a Patriots, a highly motivated Patriots team. And yet, I find myself kind of quietly confident about the possibility of the Falcons doing this.
Well, let's make the very important point that I can't envision a world in which the Bears can even begin to mount the offense that the Falcons did this year. So part of my struggle in the scenario you just described is the surreality of that possibility.
Right, but I would have come into this season saying that I can't imagine a team that has this Atlanta defense would be in the Super Bowl.
But you know, the Patriots defense has been very good lately, but this is not a year where there was a Ravens or an 85 Bears D to worry about. This
yeah, for sure.
Sort of the year of offense. But also, I think, this is the best offense in the league this year by a bit, and historically a very impressive offense that the Falcons have. One of the most creative and successful play calling scenarios that we've seen, and a defense that has steadily improved and has a lot of talented young guys on it. So, yeah. I mean, this team is ready, and I feel pretty good about them. Before we actually talk about the actual game, though, I want to get through the prop bets that will not help us break down the game.
Okay, let's do that. Let's do some props.
Because I have sorted my prop bets into three categories.
Okay.
There are the cross sport prop bets, which are sort of classics. How many points in an NBA game versus whatever.
Right.
And then there's just goofy prop bets that, like, for instance, will a player be arrested before the Super Bowl? 15-1 odds on that. So, if you're a cop in Houston, I'm just saying.
I know it's the overwhelming favorite, but I really like no on that one because. The other thing I think maybe the Falcons' last appearance in the Super Bowl is most remembered for is Eugene Robinson getting caught with a hooker the night before. There is no way an Atlanta player is getting arrested, and there's no way that a guy coached by Bill Belichick is getting arrested the night before the Super Bowl. So,
well,
it's not great odds, but take that to the bank. The no on that one.
Yeah, I will say if a guy coached by Bill Belichick does get arrested, he will no longer be coached by Bill Belichick.
well, and look, and it's not like some Bill Belichick players haven't been arrested for, murder in his time there, but usually that doesn't happen the night before the Super Bowl.
That's a good point. Yeah. And then, the third category is actual football prop bets that I think will help us talk about who's going to win this thing. But quickly, let's do cross sport first because there's only five of those.
Okay, hit me.
You can bet Patriots points versus Russell Westbrook points against the Blazers on Sunday.
Ooh, that's actually and it's there's no spread there, I'm guessing.
That is straight up.
Straight up. Patriots. That's really close too.
It's close. But I do think a bet on the Patriots there is almost a bet for them to win because we talked about Russell Westbrook is playing his butt off, and the Blazers are not a good defensive team, particularly at the guard spots. So he could go for 35 to 40 it's pretty easy to imagine that.
Yeah.
And if you think the Patriots are going to score 35-40, you think the Patriots are going to win.
Do you? I definitely could see a scenario in which the Falcons win like 38-35. I could definitely see that scenario.
Yeah, but you're giving the Pats a lot. So maybe it's not a bet for the Pats to win, but like I think I would bet Westbrook.
I think I would bet Westbrook too. The Pats are going to score. You know what I mean? Like the Pats
are
going to
score.
But I think there's a decent chance that they try to run the ball and slow the game down some, and that might keep the score lower than you think. You know,
I think the Pats' best strategy is to just hold the ball as much as they can, and I think that's exactly what they'll try to do. The next one, the Golden State Warriors are at Sacramento Saturday night, and you can bet Steph Curry points plus assists against the Pats Falcons combined first half score.
First half score. Okay.
Yeah. So do you think they will come out firing and that it will be a lot of points early, or do you expect sort of some early jitters? Because Steph points plus assists is certainly going to be over 30, you would imagine.
I think you can expect some early points. The Falcons have been crazy good on first drives this season. In fact, I think they've scored a touchdown in the last 8 or something like that.
Right.
And the Pats, hat tip to Bill Simmons on this, have been a really great second quarter team for the entire Belichick era. So that both of those stats to me suggest first half points.
Yeah, so that's a good one. You can bet Isaiah Thomas points. The Celtics host the Clippers on Sunday against Pat -2.5, which I think is almost again. This we should have Tip Bill Simmons on this too because he mentioned this one on his prop bet podcast. But I think that might be your best cross sport prop to bet on Isaiah Thomas.
Yeah,
he's been scoring a ton.
Volume scorer.
So and again, the Clippers without Chris Paul are not a great defensive team at the guard spot.
Yeah.
And then two golf ones. You can bet Phil Mickelson's Sunday score at the Phoenix Open against Pat's rushing yards -44.5.
I thought you said cross sport.
All right, let's not do the golf thing again. But Phil Mickelson, you know, score going to be in the 60s or low 70s at the Phoenix Open.
I suggest the 70s. Phil's getting up there.
So this is basically a question of, will the Pats get to like 120 on the ground?
Ooh. But that probably depends on whether you think the Pats are going to win or not.
That's exactly right. So that one's interesting to me. And then you can bet this one's undercover clever. Tiger Sunday birdies against Pats Falcons combined field goals. Now, the Patriots are a really, really good red zone defensive team. So that could mean field goals.
And Matt Ryan also is a very, very good kicker with range. So
yeah. Also, Tiger Woods might not even play on Sunday.
I would say almost certainly will not play on Sunday because you have to make the cut to do that, right?
Yeah, it's the Phoenix Open, so I mean, he's got a pretty good shot at making the cut.
I would straight side bet you right now that Tiger does not make the cut in the Phoenix Open if you want to do that.
Okay, but that's the point. You could win this bet on Friday, and then all you need is one field goal.
Yep, I like that prop.
Yeah, I would consider betting Pat Falcons there. All right, now let's quickly run through some goofy ones, because some of these I have nothing to say on except what the hell. And here's my biggest what the hell prop bet, okay? There's obviously a lot of Lady Gaga stuff. But by far the weirdest and the strangest odds I maybe have ever seen on a Super Bowl prop bet. Like, you can bet who does she cover? Let's start there, because it's less crazy. You can bet on artists for Gaga to cover.
Okay.
David Bowie 2-1, Prince 5-2, Leonard Cohen 4-1, George Michael 5-1, and Glenn Frey 8-1.
Ooh, yeah.
I would say Leonard Cohen and George Michael are not bad bets.
The odds are not great, but to me, Bowie seems like really obvious for her.
It does, but maybe is it too obvious? And the odds are too low on Bowie.
Yeah,
but 5-1 on George Michael or 4-1 on Leonard Cohen, like. Clear, a woman who made a duet album with Tony Bennett clearly has respect for Leonard Cohen.
Sure, but it's a stadium show in the Super Bowl. She's not doing Leonard Cohen. It's a lock. She's not doing Leonard Cohen.
All right, but what about Freedom or Faith? Come on.
Yeah. I think George
Michael. 5-1, George Michael?
Yeah,
I like
that. If you want to lay odds, go George Michael.
Okay, but here's the best Gaga bet. It literally says, and by the way, I verified that there are websites where you can actually make these bets for all these bets. Lady Gaga brings out a snake.
Was that a thing she did in a video?
I have no idea, but what would you guess the odds are on that?
10 to 1?
4 to 5.
Whoa! She must be doing this on the tour.
Something must be happening with a snake, but just think about the fact that she is an odds-on favorite to bring a snake out to the Super Bowl halftime show.
Somebody knows something.
What is going on? Like, that's the weirdest bet I've ever heard of, and 10 to 1 would be, like, semi-reasonable.
Yeah.
If it was a normal artist, it'd be, like, 100 to 1 minimum. She's so crazy that 10 to 1 sounds reasonable. 4 to 5? What is happening here?
You know what's not on the board is me texting you if she brings out a snake. Because that's a dead solid lock.
The odds on that would be -500.
All right. Sorry.
Yeah, it's just so weird. I don't know what to do with that. All right, but let's run through some of these other goofy props. We did play our Arrested already. Gatorade colors. This is an interesting one because it sort of comes down on a bet of who you think will win. I mean, unless you want to just bet orange or yellow, which are both 3-1. Green and clear are also 3-1. And by the way, some of these odds will have changed. But here's where the value bets are in my mind. Red is 6-1 and blue is 15-2.
Yeah, I mean, I get the value.
If I'm in Vegas, if I think the Falcons are going to win, I bet red, and I think the Patriots are going to win, I bet blue.
Yeah,
those are big odds.
I just don't see red or blue happening for either one of those teams.
Really?
Yeah, people, they don't mess with the Gatorade, man. Like it's standard colors typically. There's a reason the odds are so good on orange, yellow, and clear.
First of all, blue is a standard color.
Yeah, I know what you mean, but like, I don't know. You can't go back and track this thing, but when was the last time you remember seeing blue Gatorade on a dump?
The last Patriots win was blue.
Was it really? All right.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, well then bet blue. I don't think.
And speaking of which,
there was a Gatorade bath in the NFC Championship game, which disturbed me and made me. I did not like that.
Hint, hint. I would bet red. Belichick hoodie colors. You can bet on the color of Belichick's hoodie. Blue is 4-11 because a Patriots blue hoodie is obviously the most likely thing. Gray is 3-1, which isn't a bad bet if you're going to bet this. Red is 40-1. That seems impossible given the fact that the other team wears red. But field is 50-1. So if you want to get weird, if you think maybe he throws on a black hoodie or something, you could make some money there. Giselle on screen over under 1.5.
I kind of like the under. By the way, I'm looking at the bath from the NFC Championship game, and it was green, just so you know.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Green. Why green? Maybe that's why green is.
Because people like to drink the green Gatorade. That's ultimately that's the most determining factor. No, it's lemon lime. That's the most standard Gatorade color.
Lemon lime is yellow.
I don't know. It looks pretty green to me.
No, you're wrong. Go back to your Gatorade informational source.
I'm going to send you the YouTube link.
Giselle on screen over under 1.5. I don't know. I kind of like the over. If they win, it's definitely the over. Like, what about just one crowd shot and then a celebration shot after a Brady touchdown?
There's so many things to show with Brady.
Yeah.
You know, and the Patriots winning, you're going to see Goodell way before you see Giselle.
Giselle?
Yeah.
That's a good point. All right. This is a very, very, very weird one. And there's no chance of it happening, but I wrote it down just because it's incredible that it's on the board. You can bet at 50-1 odds that Dan Quinn will wear a hairpiece.
At 50-1?
50-1. Not high enough.
Yeah, not high enough. There's zero chance that's
bald,
happening.
And we all know he has a shaved head. Like, it's ridiculous. But I just like that that's on the board.
You got to, some people, and I consider myself in this group, you embrace the bald. You know, there's and Dan Quinn is one of those guys. You know what I mean?
I will do everything I can to hold on to the hair that I have.
Yeah.
Much like the subject of our next couple bets, Joe Buck. You can bet on his tie color and pattern, you know, polka dots versus stripes and the, like, solid color or, like, what will the primary color be.
Joe Buck, the opposite of Embrace the Bald, by the way.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. yeah. So me and Joe Buck, same team, although I have not had a hair transplant. Here's the one I kind of like. Joe Buck has been rocking the stubble lately, but you can bet 10-1 on clean-shaven Joe Buck.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Like, if you're Joe Buck,
do you shave it up for the Super Bowl?
No. I mean, how do you not bet on yourself 10-1?
He came on KNBR, actually, and said he absolutely is open to doing that.
like, what would you just...
He was like, I started hearing about some of these prop bets, and like, because there are prop bets about things he could say also.
Yeah! I'd be all in on that. It's not like it affects the game whether or not he shaves or not. Go for it, man. Make some cash.
Yeah, I know. That would be hilarious. And same thing with the tie. Just, like, wear an odd tie pattern and color, and you could make thousands of dollars. to be fair, Joe Buck's doing fine. Okay, speaking of Joe Buck, it doesn't have to be Joe Buck, but you can bet on does someone on the broadcast say the phrase, Houston, we have a problem? And the odds on yes are 5-2.
I kind of like that one. 5-2. That's a very Joe Buck thing to say.
Exactly. Going to a commercial break in some way, like there's a challenge. Something goofy happens. Houston, we have a problem.
I feel like Kurt Menefee is a good. There's a good chance he would drop that one too.
Totally. I don't know if that counts. You'd have to look deeply and see if it's only within the game broadcast or if the pregame counts.
No, but halftime, I bet that counts.
Yeah. I think there's a good chance of a Houston, we have a problem. Chance to make a little bit of
could
money.
Could you see Troy Aikman being, well, Joe, Houston, we have a problem? I kind of could. Yep.
Absolutely. They could all, like, so many people are cheesy. So many Fox broadcasters are cheesy enough to say that.
Agreed.
I think it's a solid bet. Over under, commercials parodying our president, 1.5.
Ooh. I think I like the under there.
Yeah. Yeah, there could be one. It's hard to imagine two, right?
Yeah, and I think for a lot of people, that, you know, corporations are going to feel like that's a stay away.
Right. It would have to be an upstart. It'd have to be like an E-Trade or somebody who thinks they're appealing to their audience with that.
Although
it could be a parody without being like an angry parody.
Right.
You know,
I will quickly mention that Budweiser is allegedly planning a pro-immigration ad, which I think was an interesting move on their part. So there you go.
There were also bets about whether Gaga references or protests the president or wears like a pink hat and stuff, but I didn't find those as interesting. Here's one that
we should get to the game. I feel like we could do a whole podcast on this.
I know there's three more, and we don't have to talk too much about them.
Okay.
But Luke Bryan's shirt for the anthem: black is 5-4, white is 3-1, field is 4-1. But here's your bet: red, white, and blue shirt 8-1.
Yeah, I mean, if you're looking for odds.
If Luke Bryan doesn't wear a red, white, and blue shirt to wear the anthem, then this is not Trump's America.
I don't know a ton about Luke Bryan, but he definitely strikes me as a black T-shirt kind of dude.
That's probably true, but he's singing the anthem at the Super Bowl. I think the chances he goes red, white, and blue are better than 8-1.
I'm Google imaging Luke Bryan.
He's a country star.
And he's wearing black in 80% of these photos. There's some blue.
Yeah, but this is a special.
Some plaid.
Plaid. Plaid should have been an option. All right, Floyd Mayweather. You can bet on Floyd Mayweather's bet.
You can bet on Floyd Mayweather's bet? Patriots.
Yes.
Patriots.
What? No. No, no. You can bet on the size of his bet.
Oh, Jesus.
Floyd Mayweather's biggest bet. 0-100K is +220, 100-250 +175, but your real value is in the like 500-750K is +450, 1-1.5 million is +600. So if you think Floyd's going to drop a cool mill on the Patriots in this game, you can make some real money off of Floyd making money.
I like him for about 250.
Okay. Yeah. If you like them for $250 to $500, that's +200. So something to consider. And my last one, and this is a bit of a troll move on my part, but you can bet on Tom Brady to put on a Make America Great Again hat after the Super Bowl at 22-1.
I mean, he may be in full on effort mode at that point. You know.
That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying. He might drop the trophy on Roger Goodell's foot and throw on his Trump hat for all we know.
Serious question. What do you think the chances are Brady retires after this game if they win? It's almost none.
You can bet on that if you think he will.
What are the odds?
About 12 to, it's more than 10 to 1.
I probably want more than 20 to 1, I feel like, to be honest.
Yeah, I don't think there's a very good chance.
But it's a non-zero possibility.
I mean, in as much as, like, 0.5% is non-zero. Yeah.
All right. Fair enough.
All right. So some football bets, and I think this helps us get to the answer here. I always like to look at MVP odds for the high odds guys for obvious reasons.
Mm-hmm.
My best bet before, I guess it was last year's Super Bowl, was Von Miller, and he won. And you could have gotten like 50 to 1 if you bet it early enough. And there was a very easy way to see how Von Miller became the MVP. And it was exactly what happened, more or less, which was the Denver defense dominated. Peyton Manning wasn't that good. And the Broncos won. By a similar token, I could see Vic Beasley winning MVP of this game. If the Falcons' offense is good but not great, and he has a 2 or 3 sack performance and maybe forces a turnover, and you can get Beasley at 40 to 1.
Yeah. If you're looking for high odds, guys, I agree with you. The Falcons' chances of winning this game depend on them getting enough stops. And for them, likely that's either going to come from generating pressure on Brady without blitzing, which means the four guys up front, and Beasley certainly the most likely.
It means Vic Beasley, yeah.
I mean, look, they have some other guys that can get sacks, but Beasley's the guy you want to bet on there. You know, I would say the other thing would be a game-breaking turnover, a pick six kind of thing. So I don't know if Deion Jones has odds, but he's a very fast linebacker.
I did not write him down. Here are the other MVP odds I wrote down because they interested me.
Okay.
I think the best – who would you say – if I told you the Falcons win, who's your number one guess as MVP?
Well, I mean, look, the quarterbacks are always the number one guess.
I disagree.
Really?
I mean, obviously Brady is the most likely MVP if the Patriots win, but I think Julio has an incredibly good shot at it.
I mean, look, Julio has a good shot at it, but if you're asking me who is the Falcon most likely to win the MVP, it's definitely Matt Ryan.
That might be true, but his odds are going to be very low. Julio's right. 9 to 1.
Nine to one, huh?
I think there's an easy way to envision Julio having a big day, and unlike if like Chris Hogan or Julian Edelman has a big day, I still think Tom Brady gets the MVP. If Julio has a big day, he'll win the MVP, not Matt Ryan.
That part of the logic is definitely true. I think the odds are probably higher for Julio because everybody thinks that Belichick's going to try to take him out of the game.
Yes, exactly. But that doesn't mean much as we've seen every single week that he's on the field.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure the Packers tried to do that last week and he went for 180. So
in between 9 to 1 and 40 to 1, you have both Deion Lewis and Devontae Freeman at 16 to 1. So if you think it's going to be a big running game, those are not bad odds.
What are Tevin Coleman's odds?
He's a little higher, but not high enough to pick him as the MVP.
Because to me, Freeman and Coleman, it depends on the day. You know what I mean?
And Coleman can break one big run, maybe a little more believably than Freeman. But to me, if it's a running game, that's because they're pounding it. And Devontae is the guy they generally
The Falcons really like to throw to running back, so they can be effective even in a game where they throw the ball all the time. So.
That's true, and we'll get to some stuff on that.
And the Patriots traditionally have had a hard time covering those guys, the running backs out of the backfield, so we'll see.
They have also had a slightly tough time with secondary receivers, which is why if you really want to get weird, I would give a thought to Taylor Gabriel at 66 to 1. And also at 66 to 1 is Malcolm Butler, And for obvious reasons, I think you can envision him being a factor.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I don't know what Mohamed Sanu's odds are.
Not for MVP, but I do have a Sanu bet here that I think is golden.
I like Sanu better as your random Falcons receiver to win the MVP than Gabriel, because I think that Butler will cover Gabriel some. So
okay,
given their size, skill sets, and things. So
all right, so a couple more offensive things for. I mean, most of these are offensive, but Sanu, since you mentioned him. Mohamed Sanu over under 4 receptions, and for the reason you just said, which is that Malcolm Butler is going to spend some time on Julio and some time on Gabriel, I think Mohamed Sanu is almost a lock for over 4 receptions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I like that one a lot. You can also bet on the first touchdown of the game. And again, I just wrote down some sort of higher odds ones that interest me here. That's where I wrote down Coleman is 14-1.
Yeah.
First touchdown.
Coleman is a great bet. He is less likely to, usually they start with Freeman. So, mm-hmm. So of the two running backs, you know, if you're talking about a first quarter touchdown scenario, I like Freeman's odds better, or Freeman's chances okay. better than Coleman.
Okay. For the Patriots, though, Deion Lewis at 12-1, and A, he can break one. B, they like to throw screens to him, and C, you know, if you get down near the goal line, there's just you improve the chances that a running back scores. Unfortunately, the odds on Blunt are way too low. And then here's my under.
Can I give you a couple random ones? This is thing. Keep in mind,
let me give you one first,
okay?
Because this is my undercover first touchdown, and then I'm done with first touchdown odds. Lavine Toilolo.
Just gonna say that.
He's 33-1 to score the first touchdown.
I think they're not even going to bother to cover the tight ends at the time. So
exactly, they're not going to cover him.
Will the red zone, obviously, but he's a big dude too.
He's huge, yeah. And they do. Although he's not a huge part of the offense, they do use him down in the red zone, and he's a huge target. So something to consider.
Here's the thing. I mean, and this is one of the more famous stats about the Falcons, is that 13 different Falcons have scored a touchdown on offense this year. So they will give it to anybody. Patrick DeMarco is a decent bet. Yeah, like there's a lot of possibilities there.
There are odds on both fullbacks to score a touchdown that interest me. DeMarco is 30-1, and Devlin is 55-1.
Yeah, I don't.
The Pats do use him occasionally in short yardage.
I just feel like in short yardage down by the goal line, if it's not Blunt, it's probably Brady. You know, they really like that QB sneak.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't totally disagree.
I don't think I'd. And 55-1's great. I don't think I'd throw my money there.
All right. Last two. Kicker missing an extra point. Matt Bryant has not missed one, but Gostkowski's missed a few.
Yep.
And that's 7-3, so not terrible. And then I really, this one to me, it has a lot to do. On one hand, it looks like this is a bet on the Falcons, but I think actually, if you think about it, this has a really good chance whether they're winning or losing, and that's Matt Ryan over 325.5 pass yards. Because if they win, it's likely because they threw it all over the field. And if they're losing, it's likely they will be throwing it all over the field.
Yep. And I think there's going to be a certain amount of bend but don't break in the Pat strategy sort of built in.
That is their strategy, they'll let you run up and down the field between the 20s, and then they lock it down in the red zone. So, I mean, there's a chance that Matt Ryan could throw for 350 yards and one touchdown, you know, but I do think the over is a decent bet there.
All right. I definitely have to go soon, so let's jump down and talk about this game.
Let's make predictions.
Yeah. I am fascinated to see what Belichick is going to do against this offense. The whole we're going to make you play left-handed thing, I think is really tough with the Falcons. I'm not saying that they do every single thing well.
I'll say it. They do every single thing well on offense.
But they definitely do a lot of things. They can do anything out of any formation. That's kind of what makes this offense really dangerous. And, you know, Belichick is a genius, and I'm not saying he's not capable of shutting it down, but it's going to be a unique challenge for him to do that. And
well,
then,
here's what I've spent a lot of time reading about Kyle Shanahan over the last week because he's going to be the next 49ers head coach, and my job is in part covering the 49ers. And the thing that stands out about Kyle Shanahan is, A, this quote that I keep seeing related to former players, that he really believes every single play could or even should be a touchdown.
Yeah.
The second thing is, Kyle Shanahan is a thinker. Kyle Shanahan is clever and creative, and as you said, they run all sorts of different stuff out of all sorts of different formations. And Kyle Shanahan is the sort of coach that I make the comparison to, you know, the Warriors or the Spurs. What he does is figure out how to put his guys in the best place to succeed given the circumstances. And he is not a guy who adjusts to the opponent. He's a guy that consistently makes the opponent adjust to him. And I think the biggest problem you can run into with a Belichick team is letting Bill Belichick determine the narrative and pace and the way the game goes. And Kyle Shanahan, for better or worse, is not going to let Bill Belichick determine that. He's going to force his will on Belichick's defense to the best of his ability. And that makes me feel really good about what the Falcons are going to be able to do.
Yeah. Now, the question, of course, is the other side of the ball. And yes. You know, stopping Tom Brady with a defense that hasn't been great in the red zone, where the Patriots are really great.
It's just such a hard job.
It is
a hard damn job.
And look, in a game, if you think that the ball is going to be moved a lot, which seems to be almost a certainty, third downs, you know, those 4-point plays in the red zone are going to be absolutely huge. And that does
not only that
historically, that's favored the Patriots.
Yeah. It does, and I think that's why to win this game, the Falcons have to score from outside the red zone at least once. A touchdown, I mean.
Yep.
They have got to have a big play touchdown in this game. Now,
I think that's definitely a thing the Patriots are going to be focused on taking away big plays over the top.
Yeah, and it's going to have to be, in all likelihood, that play is going to have to be a play after catch.
Yeah.
It's going to have to be Coleman out of the backfield. It's going to have to be Julio catching a slant and just exploding away like he did 2 weeks ago. It's going to have to be something where a play that doesn't necessarily draw up as a big play turns into something.
Right.
But I think they can do that. I don't think it's hard for me to even remember a team that's more suited to do that, that has more ways to do that. I mean, Aldrick Robinson could be the guy that does that.
Like, yeah.
There are so many guys on this team that can catch a ball and make something happen. I think they get it done. I do.
Yeah.
If I had to pick, I'd pick the Falcons.
I'm leaning that way. it seems crazy. I just have a lot of faith in this offense. And I have a ton of respect for the Patriots, and I think they're going to score some points because Tom Brady is Tom Brady, and
yeah,
they're going to be supremely motivated and focused and have a great, great game plan. But I just think there are a lot of weapons, and I think in the end, that's going to carry the day. And I think the Falcons know what they want to do, and will make enough plays. They'll find enough plays on defense to supplement the times that they get gashed, and there will be times where they get gashed. So,
yeah, I agree. And more, perhaps more importantly than agreeing, I desperately hope that that's the result.
Well, and I will 100% tell you that if you can find me 10 minutes into this game and the Patriots are marching straight down the field, that all of that confidence will have evaporated, and I realize that's very possible. So,
if you find Derek 10 minutes into the game with the Patriots up a touchdown and driving, you will find Derek drunk and angry.
Yeah. I mean, it's crazy to me that these words are coming out of my mouth. I am generally a person that doesn't pick against the Patriots really in any scenario.
Yeah.
And often pick against the Falcons. So,
you're just being a responsible football fan.
Yeah. So I don't take it lightly when I say, like, I think they might do this. It's sort of insane. So, I also realize that I could be setting myself up for a gigantic heartbreak.
Well, but you know what? Like, I do think, like, you can console yourself with the fact that picking your team to win is a completely reasonable proposition in this scenario.
Yeah.
You know, we never know. Anything could happen. The Patriots are an incredibly difficult opponent. They have arguably the greatest coach in the history of football coaching their team. They have one of the top three or four quarterbacks in the history of football running their team on the field. But this is not the invulnerable Patriots teams of years past, which, by the way, also lost in the Super Bowl. But this is a team where you can see the avenue to beating them, and the Falcons seem like a team that, I don't know if I'd go ideally suited to do it, but certainly appear capable.
They're definitely capable. I mean, look, the simulation odds I've seen typically have the Patriots around 59% to win. I think that's kind of fair. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
that's kind of fair.
Yeah. And, you know,
yeah.
I'm just siding with the 41 on this day.
I agree.
All right. Well, let's hope it turns out that way. And if not, we may not podcast this week because I may be hiding under the covers somewhere still on Wednesday.
Yeah. Or like deep, deep in a bender at that point.
Yeah. May still be drunk. All right, let's get out of here. I think we may have broken a podcast record for longest toy department.
Yeah, but it was especially entertaining today. So you're welcome, everybody.
Yep, I'll say it.
Bye.
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed. The lights out. Butter's getting hard. The eggs are cooling, and the Jell-O is jiggling.
So long, everybody.
And do me a favor. Have yourself a tremendous evening.